Hello and welcome to episode 2 of the Spring Podcast. Yeah, we've actually made it to the difficult second episode. So I just want to say thanks to everyone that tuned in to the first one. And thanks for your kind comments and feedback. It's very much appreciated. This is just a bit of a fun project for us, just to pass a bit of time while this whole coronavirus crack is happening. But we're enjoying it, and we're glad to see that you're enjoying it too. So Tommy Hayes is back with us.
Back by unpopular demand, yeah.
Yeah. And William Nolan is not with us this week. He may be joining us during the podcast. We're not sure. He's doing William stuff. That's as far as we can go with that. He's obviously some sort of spy, and he wouldn't be very good if he told us what he was at. But hope he's doing okay. So we have a special guest with us this week. A lot of you involved in Irish motorsport will know this man already. So we have Art McCarrick with us. So Art, do you want to give us a little bit of background and info about yourself?
Howdy, chaps. So I work for the governing body for motorsport in Ireland for my sins, and very part-time competitor as well. And I suppose I've been involved in various different areas of the sport over the last 8 or 9 years. So when I heard the podcast last week, I actually just forgot how good the 2001 season was, you know. Looking forward to being a part of it.
Isn't it funny that when you look at it, we found ourselves in 2001 with a situation of foot and mouth, and we find ourselves right now in quite a similar situation with the COVID.
Yeah, funny in a serendipitous sense, not in a ha-ha sense, I suppose. But
no.
it's mental, really. But yeah, 2001 was an unbelievable season. Like, so I'm looking forward to going through Sweden.
As we've said last week, you know, and it's again, the resources we have nowadays are just unbelievable. Like, again, big shout out to EWRC results. You know, I'd be genuinely lost without them for this kind of stuff. But also, we have to give credit to the WRC channel on YouTube, the official channel, because I think probably 8 or 9 years ago, they uploaded like a host of the older rounds onto the channel in full. Like, I mean, it's brilliant. I think you've more or less the full coverage for 2001. Bar the Safari, they put the Safari behind the paywall on WRC Plus recently for some reason. I don't know what the crack is there, but you can get it anyway. But and then they have some rounds from, we'll say, 2002, 2003, and a few more modern ones. But again, like, all that kind of served to do for me when I watched the later ones again was just show how good the coverage was in the early 2000s and how, you know, much they kind of slipped up as they went along. So, you know, I would strongly recommend, if you have a bit of time, which, you know, let's face it, lots of people probably do at the moment, to go back and just watch it. And even like, if you watch them and listen to the podcast after or vice versa, like it's just a wonderful time to be looking back on.
Actually, there's one. What happened to Jeremy Hatch? Remember him? He used to do all the voiceovers in like 2000 and 2001.
It's funny, I went chasing that up myself there a while back, and I had a couple of copies of Evo magazine.
Oh yeah.
And I found him writing, I think he must freelance a little bit between Evo and the Top Gear magazine. But I think, yeah, he's
he was really good.
Oh, he's fantastic. What I liked about Jeremy Hart was he was a bit like the cop in the movies we grew up watching. He wasn't afraid to ask the hard questions and didn't go by the book, you know. So he like, prime example being in 1998, 400 yards from the flying finish, stuck a microphone in front of Carlos's sad face, and you know, it was a brave man to do it. But I mean,
Jesus, literally the worst moment of Carlos's life there. Like, I mean, that was, and you know, I was just thinking during the week, once we have this kind of season done, we'll we'll start looking back at older events or other events, other important events, and I think GB98 is definitely up near the top of the list just the sheer drama of it, you know. But again, it's something we didn't mention last week, and I only thought of it during the week. There was a magazine out at the time called Rally Access. You guys probably remember it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, with the current lockdown situation, I don't have access to my stash. They're above my parents' house, I'd love to be able to access them for the archive material. But that was a magazine dedicated to the WRC at the time, and that magazine was absolutely brilliant. I mean, there was a guy, I'll always remember Russell Bulgin, who was one of, if you're into kind of motoring journalism, one of the absolute best of the best. And he did some brilliant features. I remember he did an interview with Tommy Mackinnon once, and he kind of did the whole, I suppose, theme behind it was Mackinnon's, you know, famed lack of communication skills. But he still made a brilliant story out of it. Russell Bulgin, now, for people who are not familiar, he would have done a brilliant feature with Ayrton Senna back in the mid-80s, where Senna went into the forest for a day and drove things like a Sierra and a 604 and stuff like that. Stuff that was just groundbreaking. He had another article as well in 91 or 2 where he took a Boreham Sierra Cosworth and used it as a shopping car for the day. Like, if you can find some of his archive stuff, it's brilliant. But he was a columnist and did some features for him at the time. And just the photography was unreal. It was a lot of McLean photography. They had brilliant event coverage. They had, you know, tips on how to go and spectate these events. It was like the lifestyle kind of magazines that were out at the time, but kind of,
there was a touch of the Loaded magazine about it. It actually had that nice style about it. It was kind of, it had an assurance in itself in the product it was promoting.
Yeah, and there was like,
you know, excellent.
This is cool.
Paper, excellent paperweight.
I was just going to say the paper was unreal as well. Yeah.
I felt bad about it at the time. Look, it's kind of one of these things of you don't know what you have till it's gone. And I really missed Rally Sport magazine, and I was kind of annoyed that Rally Access had landed on, but to be fair, Rally Access was amazing. I think it was just one filled the gap for the other one was now missing, you know. That was the unfortunate thing about it, you know.
Yeah, Rally Access kind of suited the mood of the time as well, where you had this, you know, glitzy, almost glamorous sport that was kind of, you know, to obviously the rally fans it wasn't new, but you know, you had a bunch of people that were just getting into it at the time, and you know, this kind of fed into the whole rallying suddenly cool again kind of thing. So, you know, they had all these lifestyle features on Richard Burns' apartment in Andorra, all that kind of carry on, you know. But it was great. It was again, just as you said, Tommy, we didn't know what we had until it was gone. So this week's guest sponsor, Terry Roven Paris Shop in Yavaskula, Yavas Marine. So for all your powerboating, ski, what you call them? What are those fucking things?
Jet skis.
Oh yeah,
skidoos.
Skidoos. Lawnmowers, strimmers, if you're in the Yavaskula area, Harry Ruff and Pear will sort you out. So, So, I guess...
I think I've been getting into the spirit of Sweden this week. I've had shovels out in the backyard digging my way in and out of things. So, yeah, I've really kind of got myself into the spirit of things here now. So,
yeah, and if you quote Sprint at the checkout, he'll give you a free chain of 2-stroke.
Really?
Brilliant. I haven't.
Is the Husqvarna branded stuff? Is it?
No, it's the cheap stuff. the advertising budget's not stretching. Or the hang on, he's supposed to be giving us a deal. I look, we'll have to sort this out. As I said, there's a lot of stuff to go around now. But if Harry, you're listening, and the very, very remote chance you're listening, although you should be, because we're kind of celebrating, you know, something at a high point to your career.
His only world championship win.
Yeah. Oh, spoiler alert. Ignore the last 10 seconds.
Keep listening.
On the off chance you didn't know what happened in Sweden 19 years ago. Yeah, it's not exactly fresh news. So,
We might get a couple of cases of just approaching sell-by date Red Bull, maybe. He does have the connections now, I'd say.
Maybe so. We'll see.
Nepotism is great, like, you know.
Yeah. Whenever this lockdown lifts, we'll see what we can do. But
yeah.
Anyway, moving on to the business in hand. Sweden 2001. Obviously, the second run of the championship, the traditional follow-on from the Monty. And it's interesting to note that this year they actually moved the event further north compared to where it was in the previous years due to global warming, which is obviously pertinent when you consider what happened this year, where the event almost didn't run due to a lack of suitable conditions in the stages. So, but thankfully in 2001, that had the desired effect. You had just absolutely beautiful Swedish rally conditions. Like, there was enough snow in the days leading up to the event to leave, you know, really, really nice road surface and also decent snowbanks, you know, the proper high ones that you can actually lean on. But for the spectators anyway as well, it was beautiful because I think the Friday and Saturday, just going by the coverage, and the weather was gorgeous. It was just clear, cold, crisp. Just looked like a dream to be there. And like, if anyone ever gets around to inventing that time machine that so many of our fans are looking for, I think the first couple of days of Sweden there would be, you know, definitely ones to go to.
What I liked about the schedule they had was very, very little repeating of stages. I think in the whole schedule they seemed to, like the final day, there were two stages that were repeated twice within it. But during the rest of it, I think there might have been only two stages that got repeat. Everything seemed to be a one pass through them, and that was it. I mean, much more of a challenge, I think, for the drivers to get it right first time, you know.
Yeah, they seemed to move around a bit more. You know, they had different service bases, you know, for each day, which is obviously, you know, the regulations dictating central service areas were a little bit different back then. But it just gave it a little bit more variety, as you say, to the roads they were using and stuff.
Like, when you look, the entry list, just like to give an idea of just if anyone's interested out there, 380 stage kilometres is what the rally was going to cover. It had 75 entries. Of the 75 entries, 37 of them were running in the A8 class, which would be, as we know, World Rally cars and formerly Group A cars such as the Subaru, Impreza 555, etc. 16 of these were works entries, with 19 Group N entries in Class 4. There's actually two notable entries in this now. I don't know if they're of any interest to people. Car 64, some young lad called Loeb got an entry. He must have come in off the reserve list. And
what was he in?
I think he was in a Saxo VTS. There was only two out in the class, you know, so he stood a good chance of picking up a pot, but I think he blew the engine or something. And
Saxo VTS, what a York.
Yeah, I think he had the max power kind of neons on it as well.
Oh,
for added scene points, you know. But you're kind of in the latter, you're in the latter days of the 2-liter F2 cars as well. And there was only five entries in that, but some of the cars were interesting in that there was a Astra run by Persvan and Jonas Kruse is out in the end. But the most interesting car out of that was a Saab 9-3 kit car, which I knew very little about until
recently. What?
A Saab 9-3 kit car. The only previous out.
Yeah, they were
couple around the VRC or something.
Kit car. Yeah. But they were turbo front wheel drive and turbocharged, I think, but they ran in class A7.
I saw
one of them crop up somewhere recently. Yeah.
And you honestly think of a car less suited to Rally Sweden than a Formula 2 car? Unless it was rear wheel drive, of course.
I don't know.
Like that would have been a heavy machine too.
He was from what I've seen, he was batting it fairly closely with Jonas Kruse and Persvan, and neither of them would be slow coaches in that environment. So they're obviously treated.
There was another one there. Actually, while you're on the entry list there, Tommy, there was another one. There was Ben Bryant and Connie Hook
from Blue Peter.
Blue Peter presenter.
Yes,
and she's married. She's married to
Charlie Brooker,
Black Mirror.
She
navigated in that event. And she did like three or four, I think, rallies before that. It was part of a Blue Peter thing.
Yeah, I remember that.
She did Rally Sweden. Yeah, just have to
might
see
be something for our It's a good point, Eric. Something for our UK listeners there, just to prove that, you know, we do have the foreign channels as well here in Ireland. We do, you know, we are aware.
Well, he might have had. I didn't. I had to wait until the Tuesday after the event to listen to Peter Collins butchering the commentary to get my fix.
Well, hang on, no. We had them. Well, okay, Art might have them slightly more legally than we did, but up in North Tipperary, we had a little thing called a deflector system. Needless to say, we had it, right? That's
just we were getting a beam from Enniskillen.
Yeah.
Up in Sligo there.
Some lad's field with a big mirror.
We had the direct line. Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Just like the note, and following on from our mention of, you mentioned your time, the sheer amount of AA cars is actually spectacular. And favorite of the podcast from episode one, Frederick Dorr, he's there in a P2000. So shout out to
it. This was at the end of the Teams Cup, wasn't it? The Privateers Trophy at the time. Wasn't that what it was called? The Teams...
They ran that up to either 2000 or 99.
I'm just looking at the entry list here. There's guys that have TC besides the A8. I'm just wondering if... Yanis Kulig did it in the Marlborough Focus, and there was randomers like that. Yeah. I wonder if the Teams Cup was still going. Because it filtered out fairly quick after that, anyway.
And after spotting... a kind of an interesting number plate there for entry number 36, Thomas Herdinka. I'm definitely pronouncing that wrong. But anyway, he's a Czech driver. And the number plate of that car is P18WRC. So for bonus nerd points, Art and Tommy, why is that car relevant to
chassis number one, isn't it? Chassis number one?
Yeah, she started her life as P555WRC, I'm pretty sure, and then went on to win the Lakes in 2003 in the hands of Donnelly, and just saw a lot of action over here, actually, to be fair, that car.
And bigger staff had it and couldn't sell it for like years, and then the value of them started going mental, and then he sold it, and then I think someone redid it and completely sold it.
Again, I'd just like to give EWRC a huge shout out again, because I'm after finding out that Grégoire de Mévius rallied that car in the Belgicom colours back in the day. I mean, this is like, for guys that are... It's just rally fans of our era, guys in their like late 20s, early 30s. I don't know about you, I've got a huge like fascination with like European rallying from my childhood. Do you know the privateer WRC cars?
It seemed more exotic, I think.
Yeah, it seemed more exotic. And they always had class sponsors.
Yeah. The liveries.
Fag sponsors and telecom companies and just big money. Like, it
was just
what used to sum up for me was like you'd go to someone's house, right? And I don't want to go to, you know, relatives' houses that had satellites on the off chance that you might get a glimpse of some kind of exotic rally car from Belgium or, you know, Poland or something like that. And, you know, it would make the week, you know.
It's a pretty tenuous reason to go to someone's house, Tommy, like on the off chance you'd get a fucking...
Not only did he say it was the only reason he'd go to someone's house. looking through the RT guide at Sky Sports, the Rally World would be on at like 11:30 on the cycle over to the cousin's house.
As a final note, to add to the whole great European rallying, and again, look, this is something we can probably do a podcast on, and probably will, depending how many people actually care and how bored we are. But sure, look, we might give it a go. Grégoire de Mévius' tenure with P18WRC, at one point he entered the car under the Belgicom Turbo Team entry, which is like one of the best names I've ever heard for an entry into a rally for the 1998 Buckles de Spa. Again, look, my pronunciation is going to be horrendous for any Belgians out there, but look, we'll drive it on. So
I wonder, was that a 97 car? I think it was a 97 car.
It would have been chassis number one, sure. She would have been.
Because that was the first right-hand drive car too, then I think that Harper converted as well. But anyway, that's tangents altogether.
Yeah. Look, we'll get back to the rally in hand. So, okay, thanks for lads. That's a pretty, as I said, same as with the Monty, and like it's, and even like some of the more continental European events back in the day, later on the year, like the Catalonian stuff. And even Finland, like even though Finland is not really continental, but however, the numbers of World Rally Cars that turned up for those events was huge. And even for Sweden at the time, this was big. Like, there's some money there. Like, when you look at all the gear, because these were like
50% of the entry were A8 cars. Like, that's phenomenal. Like, you could say that at a rally now, where you go look at a WRC event and half them are the World Rally Cars. Yeah, there's only probably, you know, 30 of them in doing Mexico anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And number 40 as well, we've ex-world champion Stig Blomqvist, and I think he a 7 or 8-time Sweden winner at that stage. He was, you know, the king of Sweden there at one stage, and not legally the king of Sweden. He wasn't ruling over the whole country, but, you know, for the rally. And under David Sutton Carr's limited entry in an Evo. So that's a nice little bit of you know, 80s Group B kind of tie in there with the rally. So, but yeah, so on to the main event. So just looking at the top of the intro list there, we've Harry Rovanpera, as previously mentioned, the sort of semi-official sponsor of this podcast this week, into the Works Peugeot team. So obviously Panizzi was left at home, Rovanpera being the man
the mad thing there, just to jump in, you would have thought they brought him in as a specialist and they never nominated him for manufacturer points. He got driver's points, but he never got manufacturer's points. And I'd say Peugeot were probably kicking themselves afterwards after all that happened. I think Ariel and Granholm were the two that were nominated, and Ariel was dosed with the flu.
He was
I don't know how late you can change it.
He was so Ariel was so sick for the whole rally. The man should just not have been near a rally car that weekend. He, like, they interviewed him at the start of the first day, like, and he couldn't even open his eyes hardly. He couldn't even wear his sunglasses. Joe, those manky sunglasses he had on the whole the rest of the year.
Viper Higgins sunglasses.
Yeah. Fucking Oakley job. But
I'm furiously throwing away my sunglasses here right now.
I'm pretty sure William, we can speak ill of him since he's not on here to defend himself, so we'll have a go off him. Pretty sure he still has a pair of that as well. So I would be known to wear them fairly regularly. But so that was Ariel, as you say, just a bit of an oversight by Peugeot to but because he was a little bit of an unknown quantity, you know. Up to then, he'd had his good results, as we mentioned in the first podcast, on some loose surface events, especially in 2000. He was just a little bit more looking into it. He did a couple of rallies for Sayat in 2000, was kind of dropped for the middle of the year, and came back again for GB. But it was a bit of a leap of faith, but it was to
work. And he had a mighty run in Finland 1 year in a Corolla. I don't know if that was 2000 or 2019.
So no, and Harry, a very very good driver, and obviously the wood doesn't fall too far from the trees with the young fella. Kelly is going to be the next big thing whenever rallying actually gets going again. But be interesting.
But he was knocking on the door of it really for a while. Like, I was thinking about it there, I started thinking, you know, geez, Harry was about 33, 34 when he got this crack at it. Then you're like, well, really, no, because he was, you know, there since about 96, you know, in the 2 liter cup with the, like, he had a huge amount of experience too, you know.
Kind of like Granholm was. Those guys had done lots of time and mileage and WRC events before they really kind of started getting the results.
He was the parallel to draw with it.
Well, once they got there, they were hard to get rid of. But they had a fairly similar trajectory up to 99 when they both kind of got works drives.
And then, on a similar vein, Mitsubishi brought in Thomas Radström, a Swedish specialist.
Former winner.
What year did
94.
He win? When a non-championship year, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Very good. Now, what was he in?
Stalika.
Oh, very good. Very good. I suppose, yeah, back then, there was a couple of years it wasn't counting for the manufacturer's title. 93 was it, or 92, Mats Jansson won it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a weird rotation system going on there for a few years, trying to leave everyone out, but no one was ever happy with it.
It was only like, you know, when the WRC era kicked off in 97, the World Rally Car era, that they kind of said, right, these are the rallies, these are the rounds they're going to. Like, as you said, when they had this really, really strange rotation, 95, 96, and they kicked Monty out in 96 and all this kind of bracket, I don't think anyone was happy with that. Even Finland was missing 95. And, you know, it was almost like a two-part championship over the 2 years. It wasn't.
I think in those days it was only an 8-round championship as well, wasn't it?
It was.
So
the F2 Cup, I think, ran parallel to it in some parts.
Yes.
So Finland in 95 ran, but you know, none of the big teams, really, with the exception maybe of Rally Art, I think, turned up, and Macklin, I think, may have won it. Can't be sure, but anyway.
And Radström. It's interesting to see Radström. Radström had done some, you know, good events in Sweden and the previous couple of years in Toyota Team Sweden, Corollas and stuff like that. Around this era, and maybe going back a little bit earlier, the WRC went the same way as all other motorsports, and you had drivers that were, and even co-drivers that were starting to turn into, you know, proper athletes in the same way you'd see in F1 and stuff at the time. I think Radstrom was a bit of an exception. He was a big boy inside in the car, so, you know, it was just unusual to see it. Like,
even he probably needed to be for that car because he seemed to be very physical with it from the onboard footage.
Yeah, he really, and just an interesting thing to note about the car that Radstrom used. It was on an S ridge, which is like a 99 UK ridge, if memory serves me right. But as far as I know, no, I need to confirm this, that was actually the car that did the bulk of the winter testing work over the winter 2000-2001, and would have, you know, been the test car for a lot of the improvements brought out with the Evo 6.5, as they call it. We'll say the Tommy Mäkinen edition would have been the road car equivalent, but Tommy would have done a lot of miles in that over the winter, so that was they obviously must have left it in Sweden and or up in Scandinavia, and that's the car that Thomas got for the event. But yeah, he was pretty dialed into it, you know. He was thereabouts from the start. So, and again,
and that was the and I know it always gets brought up, that was the car that ruined Freddie Lights. You know, that fellas either gelled with that car or they didn't. And for anyone to sit into it, whether it was on a one event basis or not, to knock a result out of that car, it's fairly impressive, you know.
Some going, yeah, and we'll see, as we'll see, you know, through this event as well. Poor old Freddie, God Almighty, he was. I often wonder what the crack was. Like, was there a Marlboro tie-in with Freddie to say that he held on to the seat? No disrespect to the guy, as we said in the last podcast, you know, he was seriously quick at the start of his career, and you know, he went on to win Ypres, I think, is it 9 or 10 times or something crazy. Like, you know, brilliant driver on his day, but man, it was nearly sad to watch, you know.
I honestly think if he'd gone to any other team other than Mitsubishi, he would have been away and up and gone with it, and would have been right up there with the best of them. That car, he never seemed to got it, and other people that sat into it, there was a couple of people sat into it. Granholm did a rally for Mitsubishi, and
Gerdemeister,
and I think there might have been someone else, maybe Agini or someone like that, and they never really got to grips with it. It was a car really developed and built around Mäkinen and Burns to a lesser degree, and that was it. But Lights just never seemed to get it.
Yeah, Gerdemeister did Finland actually later on this year.
Stay tuned to see what happened there.
Stay tuned, yeah. So, kicking things off, stage one, 21 kilometer stage. And just it's interesting to note again the time of year, the location, in the world. The stages started quite late in the morning and finished quite early in the evening. They were obviously fighting the darkness. They didn't want too many cars running, you know, towards the dusk. Obviously, dusk in Sweden with the glare from the road and everything wouldn't be too nice. So and Granholm was actually quickest out of the blocks. He obviously had a favourable road position following his retirement in the Monte. And just looking at the leaderboard as well, it definitely favoured the guys that were running back the field early on anyway. There was obviously quite a severe coating of snow, and Mäkinen was dropping loads and loads of time on day one. Signs as well to a slightly lesser degree, but you actually had Burns and McRae second and third, followed by Radstrom. So I think it definitely suited the guys with the favourable row position, and something we still see to this day. But
well, big time. Like, you look at it here, and the times from the likes of McRae and Burns throughout day one, they were setting the fastest times, if not second fastest times on them. So the row position really was coming into play for them.
Yeah,
but there was one particular stage in there that really impressed me. They ran a 49 kilometer stage in the middle of the day, which I kind of thought to myself, yeah, that's your switch on, and that's it. There's nowhere to hide inside there.
Yeah, just on the McRae and Burns, you know, obviously we're looking at the stage times throughout the event, and if you just look purely at the stage times without looking at the overall from kind of the middle of day one onwards, you think, hang on a second, how far in the lead were they? But what actually happened was Burns got stuck in stage two, Got stuck on just a square left, just a stupid small off. You know, there wasn't any speed involved. Just braked a little bit too late. Got stuck up in a bank, and that was it. He couldn't. I think he lost something like 13 or 14 minutes just trying to get the car off the bank. The spectators were doing what they could, and that was his, you know, chance at any sort of a result. Pretty much gone. And then McRae on stage three. Joe, we kind of mentioned the good snowbank conditions at the start of the event. The only thing with the snowbanks was it's really easy to, you know, lean on them just a little bit too much, and if they give way, you're gone, you're sucked in. That's exactly what happened to McRae in stage three. So basically the British interest for the rally was more or less done three stages in. But from then on, I think bare two stages.
I think out of between the two of them, they won 13 out of 17 stages.
That is some going. And they were winning them well. Like they were taking chunks out of the people behind. Like, so it's just
half a second a kilometre, I think, that calculated McRae was quicker than anyone during the rest of the next seven stages or something.
Oh.
Yeah, that's, and even the very last stage of the rally, Burns was fastest on a 21 kilometre stage. He was fastest by 13 and a half seconds.
Well,
it's
fair going. That's fair hammering, and it just makes you wonder, like, how well they would have had. Obviously, the advantage raw position on day one, they would have been a little bit more restricted on the subsequent days. But you know, I imagine they definitely would have been up there. And the
mad thing was, well, with Burns, the mad thing was, this is in the days before Super Rally. Like, he'd lost 13 minutes. I think he ended up finishing the rally in 16th or whatever. Now, there was no need for him to go and start the third leg of the rally at all, but he did. As the year went on, you know, the first two rallies there, Burns is on no points at all. And he still went and finished that rally, which I think says something about the man.
I think as well, you know, to your point there, the lack of Super Rally, but they would have, you know, there were new stages that year. They would have wanted to maybe, you know, give a go of them for the following year. And, you know, this is you often saw it back in the day. McRae, unfortunately, due to the fallibility of the focus, was doing a lot of it in 99. He was just, you know, he was minutes and minutes behind due to various issues, but he was keeping going. I remember he even threw the York off at a rate of knots in San Remo in 99. You know, there was no real reason for it to be going that hard, but it was, look, that's the way those guys were, you know. Yeah. And looking at just the results from stage two, Rovan Pera was quickest on stage two. So there's, you know, an early kind of indicator of what way the event was gonna pan out. So, and I think he actually had brake troubles for a lot of the first day. So, you know, to be doing that was good going. Obviously, he was, after settling into the car, really quickly, but just the Scandinavian guys, you know, you still see it to this day, but especially in that era, like, they were just untouchable at home. I mean, this is before Loeb came on the scene, and, you know, back then it was still, you know, totally Scandinavian dominated event in a similar vein to Finland. But and then just looking back along the field with Daniel Carlson again, another kind of familiar name from the mid-2000s, and a man who did Rally Ireland when it was still a candidate event for the WRC. Yeah, he's second drive in a World Rally car. He set a fourth quickest time on the second stage. So good old showing from the local boys there. But on stage three then, Granholm, actually started happening in stage two. It showed it on the footage. Granholm's York started going sick again. For a guy to be, you know, world champion the previous year and have the year that he had in 2001, like, it was a bit like McRae's year 96, only I don't think, you know, this was Granholm's fault as much as the issues that McRae had in 96. It was just one of the worst years a man could have.
He was absolutely poxed on every event.
But to be fair, in 2000, everyone else seemed to bear the brunt of the unreliability of, if the Peugeot was going to be unreliable, it was usually someone else that happened to, like, he had a good year. It just seemed to be, unfortunately, the hand he got dealt for 2001 was that this isn't going to really pan out well for you in terms of reliability here and there. You know, that seems to be the way that cookie crumbled for him, unfortunately.
It was overheating that got him again, but I think the way it happened, he had another stage before service. You could hear the car was sick in stage two. You know, there was steam and everything coming, like, so there was obviously getting...
He'd be used to that with saunas anyway, so...
Yeah, but he even said it after himself, you know, that they were going to have a look at it, but this time the engine was completely destroyed. So that was the end in no uncertain terms. I'd say even if there was Super Rally back in the day, he wouldn't have been able to stay going. But just looking at the rest of my notes, as we mentioned, likes... He was the next man to go off, similar kind of off to McRae, just lent a bit too hard in a snowbank, and in he went, and that was his the end of any chance of a good result for him. But and then looking at the leaderboard at the end of the day, we kind of start to see a bit of a pattern emerging for the rest of the event. Sainz was actually leading at the end of day one, you know, and this is again, have we mentioned Sainz again? You know, it's the same in the Monty. He's always there or thereabouts, and all of a sudden, there he is. You know, he's just an incredible man back in the day for the levels of consistency he was able to bring. We had Rovan Pera in second, and Radstrom in third, and Aurel in fourth, which is, you know, a pretty decent showing from a man who, as we said, probably should have just been in bed. And he'd mack it, and then in fifth, you know, so he was 35 seconds behind, so he didn't... In the grand scheme of things, didn't lose a huge amount of time, you know, all things considered. So he was well placed to kind of fight for the rally in the remaining couple of days. And then Kenneth Eriksson did in sixth, which is a decent showing from the Hyundai, the last outing for the original Evo 1. So that was day one.
Mäkinen probably, I think, might have taken a slightly slower time maybe in the last stage to get into that position for day two, because... the further back you are, maybe on the road.
Yeah. Anything you want to add from day one, Art?
Just like there's other drivers there as you look down the list, and they were only just coming onto the... Like, if you were to judge them on their 2001 performances, you wouldn't have maybe predicted what they would have got onto. Like, look at their Solberg in eighth. Where was Marco Martin was down at 21st. They set some decent times going on, but there was guys down that field that were going to become massive names and big contenders in a few years. Tony Gardemeister was there too after... He led Monty after the first stage, didn't he?
Yeah.
He did. Private 206. So
he was cruising about there. And this is probably one of the last... 2001 was maybe one of the last years where a privateer and a satellite-run team could kind of mix it and get into the results, get right up there.
That's something we're going to maybe touch on later as well with it, because by the looks of it, Subaru appeared to have had a day from hell, because Marco Martin was lying as high as fourth, then decided to plant it off on the fourth stage and lost a ball of time. Burns recovered his escapade into the snowbank already, and Solberg, to be honest, you've hit the nail on the head there. Like, you couldn't judge Solberg at this stage really on his performance, because, you know, still a driver learning his craft at the top of the sport, you know.
He was a fairly high profile swoop from Subaru. Like, I think the bottom out of his contract at Ford at the time, and he had done a few rallies in 2000, so 2001 was to be kind of his breakthrough year. As it happened, it didn't happen for another year or a little bit, but
I think what happened with him in Sweden was that he'd had, you know, he'd shown good pace on the Monte, you know, he was well set for a decent result if he'd kept it on the road, made a small mistake and put the yoke on his roof, and that was that. But he was warned by Subaru before the rally, just bring the yoke home. I'd say that probably influenced his showing throughout the rally. He was never really on the pace. Again, unusual for a guy that, you know, lived a few kilometres away from where the rally was happening. He was, as far as I know, he's only just over the border. So, and to compare, as you said, you know, where he ended up in subsequent years, you wouldn't have thought he was all that hot at the time. But like Petter was a guy you kind of forget that he'd been rallying again for quite a long time. It's like the what we said with Rovan Pera on Granholm. Petter was in an Escort WRC in 1999. He was in Salikas for years before that, himself and Henning, you know, take the conjuncts out of each other in various national rounds and things like that. Had went through a small apprenticeship with Ford, you know, he'd put in some decent performances. It was after Finland in 2000, I think, when Subaru swooped in, he did that pretty spectacular off in the Focus. But yeah, as you said, you know, you wouldn't, looking at this performance, if you told someone at the time that this man was going to be, you know, world champion in a couple of years' time, I don't think they would have believed you. But yeah, it's just the nature of the sport. And again, looking at the names there, like in the top leaderboard, like you've just superstars and superstars. There's no one there that's, you know, not there on merit. You don't have any the kind of pay driver sort of guys up there or anything like that. It's pure and utter talent. So
16 worked entries, you know. I suppose, like, so when you're fighting in amongst that talent pool, and you know, you're fighting over tenths of seconds, there's no real disservice in being 10th quickest in that, because the fact that the guys that you're racing against, you know, your peers, are probably they were the best of the best.
Yeah, they were.
To quote Top Gun, obviously. That has to be the reference point for all this kind of driving material anyway. So.
Yeah. So it's another, just an interesting point to note, that after a day of leaning on the snowbanks, it's amazing to see how scruffy the cars were starting to look. Like, the 206 was the shortest, but because of the regulations, the linked regulations, they had to run those big bumpers. And this is like almost Harry's trademark. You'd rarely see the car with the rear bumper intact. It was always hanging off or bits missing out of it or whatever. And this is the case here as well. And there was
the length of the towing eye is impressive.
Yeah.
And there's some kind of a protruding thing as well to push out the bumper as well. Like, you can see that the bumper is way back further than where the bodywork should end.
Yeah, I can imagine just ex Seat Sport engineers cursing in Spanish when they saw that, you know, thinking that when they thought they couldn't use the Ibiza. Yeah, and just to see, you know, the cars looked, you know, still relevant to the road car bases, we'll say. But you could see the bare carbon on the bumpers and stuff, which told its own story. You know, you had these relatively normal-ish looking cars, but the cost of a World Rally car back then wasn't far off what it is now. You know, when you adjust for currency.
Oh, not with the money Peugeot were throwing at it at the time. You know, no way. That thing was developed like for a World Rally car to come out of the box then and be fast. Like the 206 was fast straight away, and it only got faster. It was probably one of the strongest cars of that era.
Does anyone remember seeing the testing video? I don't think Peugeot ever thought it would be released. They obviously invited someone along with a camera to the test, where Panizzi rolled it in testing, where it clipped the wall. And it was just before the car made its debut in Corsica in 99, and he made an absolute ball of the car.
That was a big crash, actually. Yeah, I remember seeing footage. A
very violent accident.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not on the topic.
No, that's okay. we seem to have a bit of a habit of going off topic. Shout out to our friend Dave as well, actually, who mentioned that we go off topic too much, but you know, we're teaching you stuff you didn't want to know, Dave.
Another friend, Dave. We have another friend of ours, Dave, who does a bit of drifting. There's a car in the top six overnight, and there's a bit of that car in his drift car.
It's the same Dave. It's the same Dave. Yeah.
Is it the same Dave? He thinks he's Staffan Parmander, basically.
Yeah. Dave is rocking an ex Staffan Parmander ONT seat in his drift car. Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
That's cool.
Yeah, it is. Isn't it? It's one of those big seats as well. You know,
with the huge
ears
on it.
Yeah, 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 yeah. With the slats for that's what I can see out. It's pretty cool now. But yeah, so shout out to Dave. Hope you enjoy the multiple diversions we've made again this week. But anyway, so
alternative road book.
Yeah. So just getting back on topic, day two was, you know, went pretty much the same as day one. Yeah, looking at the times again, there was a setting up for a good battle between Rovanpera and Mäkinen heading towards the end of the rally. Again, like, you have to, you know, hand it to Rovanpera. This is a pretty decent showing under a lot of pressure. You know, his team leader, the 2000 world champion, is gone. The other guy, the ex-world champion, Oriol, is barely able to see. And here he is, you know, in his first event in the Wachs car, and he's leading the rally, you know. And you've got Mäkinen breathing down his neck. Again, we mentioned it in Monte, that, like, of all the people you could have behind you, you just don't want this Terminator, you know, in this pig ugly red thing, you know, behind you going into the final day. Cause you
with his name, with his name on the front of it.
That's it, yeah. They had his name in the front of it and everything. Yeah.
Just to reinforce that he's coming to get you, you know.
He was coming.
In,
like,
case,
yeah,
you forgot. Like.
Yeah, yeah. So just because we haven't mentioned Skoda yet in the podcast after our slandering of their good name last week, poor old Amon Schwartz went out on stage 8. He was just breaking into the top 10, but got caught up by another snowbank-related incident. Just got sucked in, so... Poor old Armin.
Well, he didn't like it, but he had to go along with it. Like, the snowbank was going to give under the weight of that Octavian.
Here we go again.
But to be fair, he was unlucky. He was unlucky.
Like, if you look at the onboards of any of those crashes, like, you can get away with it. It's just you might have hit it in just a weak spot where someone might have glanced off it beforehand, and that was it, you know.
I think that's what did for McRae as well, because the fact that they were running a bit further back, they were setting quicker times, but the previous cars had been leaning on the snowbanks, and when they got to them, they were probably that bit weaker.
Watch it, like, again, this kind of ties back into the coverage again, but watching the helicopter shots from back then, and I think more so than now, because they tended to leave the shots flow more rather than chopping and changing to the in-car and, you know, different angles or whatever. There's some beautiful examples of where a car is just drifting in fourth or fifth gear, you know, at a pretty decent angle now to the apex of the corner. They touch a snowbank and you can just see it's not a hard impact. It just kind of like an invisible hand just pushing the car back into line. It's just so beautiful to watch, you know. Again, it's one of those kind of iconic images of the time, and it's something that I think the coverage these days can learn from, you know. But so day 3, the conditions had changed overnight, and the blue skies of the previous 2 days were gone, and we had some pretty serious snow. You know, it was heavy to the point where his tire choice is becoming an issue again, because the guys that were first on the road, they weren't at as much of a disadvantage because the snow was actually settling in between each car. So, you know, running second or third or fourth back in the road, you didn't have as much of an advantage as you had in the previous 2 days, because the road was pretty much as it was for everyone. That worked
perfectly for Rovanpera. Like, I'm just looking there. Mäkinen was 7.3 seconds behind him going into the final leg. So what was that? 5 stages? The final leg was 97 competitive, 97.5 competitive kilometers.
Yeah,
like, you would put your house back then. You would have put your house back then on Mäkinen and reeling him in.
The man who really suffered, it has to be said, was Sainz. I mean, Sainz went from leading overnight on day one, and basically through sweeping the roads for them, found himself starting day 3 in 4th. 28.5 off the lead, you know. And Mäkinen had the reverse effect, went from 5th to 2nd, you know. So yeah, it just goes to show the importance of the road position.
Yeah, but just another like example of how well Rovanpera was going on this event. I think there might have been a slight difference in tire choice between Rovanpera and Mäkinen, but and Mäkinen, and like, this is you know, Mäkinen is obviously is one of the biggest legends of the sport. Very magnanimous guy, you know. He did give lots and lots of credit to Rovanpera for how he's driving. It wasn't the case of just blaming the car or the tires, or, you know, he was lucky. He genuinely praised Harry for his drive, you know. And imagine Harry, you know, again at that stage in his career, just back into a work seat, and a 4-time world champion, the king of the sport at the time, is there telling you how good you're going. Like that must have felt pretty good for Harry, and probably gave him a little bit of a lift going into the final three stages. So, but all credit to the guy, he played a blinder. He didn't really put a wheel around for the whole rally. And like
he actually finished. Sorry, there. He actually finished it out. Like, he took the lead halfway through the second there properly after leading just on the second stage for a while, and then he took the lead then on 9 and held it to the end. It was actually was only fastest on one of those stages. It was as measured a drive as you'd get. That's why you would have said that Mackinnon going into the final day would have been the favourite. You wouldn't have expected someone to be able to control a rally from the front the way Robin Perry did, and never did again, because he never got
the opportunity.
Yeah, well, I think he had three or four second place finishes in Australia. He always went well there. Mm-hmm. But he to finish out an event, usually the guys that get their one world championship win, it's maybe in slightly freak circumstances, or you know, the snatch it on the last stage or whatever. And this was as controlled and as measured as you get. It's a different one-off win than the others in a couple of different ways.
It was. I think Robin Pera, throughout his career as a works driver in the subsequent years, he was better than the results show. He always went well at home, obviously. But there was numerous events there where he could have, you know, notched up another win. It's just unfortunate, as you said, the fashion in which he controlled this event was not common for a guy. If you look at the likes of Duval in Australia, his win, his sole win, you know, that was a lucky one. There's a couple of more events here and there like that, but no, all credit to the guy. He drove brilliantly.
Because what he did on the last day, yeah, he didn't have to be fastest everywhere, but all he had to do was be faster than Mackinnon.
Yeah.
And obviously going into the last stage, he had put enough of a buffer between himself and Mackinnon that Mackinnon had to try and go above and beyond on the last stage, and I'm sure we'll get to that.
I was just moving on to it.
He pressured Mackinnon into that, yeah.
This is what I can't understand. Why did Mackinnon, you know, the guy, he as aggressive and odd as he was still a clever bloke. He was still a four-time world champion, and you don't get to be a four-time world champion by just driving to win rallies and not to win championships. So he took a bit of a risk, I think, with the tyres in the final stage. He went for, I think,
Robin Pear. Snow tyres.
Yeah, Robin Pear went for more of an ice tyre. So he thought he had a chance, but like looking at the times, he was nearly 18 seconds, slightly more, just over 18 seconds behind
Robin Pear. 21K stage. Like he was really going to have to be hoping that Robin Pear was back enough and that everything was going to go in his favour in there, because
second a kilometre,
to take that kind of time is
at that level, like it's pretty rare now to see that. So it is surprising to see him do that. And I guess Macklin's confidence was back up at the time. He'd just come off winning the Monte after a pretty torrid 2000 season. They'd obviously felt that the work they'd done on the Evo 6.5 was bearing fruit, and they felt that they had a package. He felt like he could push, he felt he could take the risk that early in the year. He wasn't obviously thinking too hard about points that early in the year, but like as we go through the year, you'll see like those 6 points, oh my god, they would have made all the difference towards the end.
I don't know, I often wonder if he thought that he had points in the bag from Monty and he could afford to let himself go, because the guys that he would assume that he would be fighting with at the end of the year, and again, it's hard to believe Mackinnon to be that naive, but Granholm was out, Burns and McRae weren't going to score points. I'm still going to be better off than them at the end of this anyway. Maybe he did just completely go for it. But like you say, as the season played out, there were so many. Honest to God, I'm delighted that you're covering this year in particular. I think it was the most fascinating year in the World Championship that there ever was. It was so open all the way. And Sweden for lots of reasons, actually, was a really, really interesting one.
Yeah.
Because none of the title contenders got anything out of it.
For the first half of the season, almost, if you, we'll get to it as we go through the rest of the season. Like, if you looked at the points positions compared after, say, six or seven events compared to where they were at the end of the year, it was almost like two different years. You know, there was almost no correlation. But and I think the overall points tally for the top three drivers at the end of the year was really, really small compared to where it had been in previous and subsequent years. It was
minimal.
Yeah, it was almost like it just reminds me of 1982 in Formula One, where Keke Rosberg won the championship after winning one race, you know, and it was that kind. It was open for various reasons, obviously some tragic reasons in that case, but it was open for, you know, till the end, and it was just almost like a championship.
The older
nobody wanted
the
to win
older
it.
Scoring system. Yeah, the older scoring system helped a lot as well, you know, with only the top six getting points.
Yeah.
Am I the only person that misses that? It delivered more of a sense of achievement of when you did get a point. Even when you look in Formula One now, they celebrate a team getting a point. You finish 10th, you get a point in anything now. And it's kind of like, it's almost as if the participation trophy has been brought into, you know, frontline
I suppose the minute they brought in Rally 2, the points had to change. I'm not sure if they changed before that or not. But that system, manufacturer points were down to 10th place in that season anyway. But the top six were just for drivers.
That was the thing. Like, yeah, if you look at the points towards the end of the year, you had, the guys that, as you said, did do well on a couple of their specialist rallies. You know, they weren't a million miles away towards the end. So
I think Rovan Pera, by the end of the season, I think with three rounds to go, if I remember, he was still in an outside shot because he had been just clocking up points. Oh, we need to check this as we go along. But I'm fairly certain, remembering that he still had an outside chance going in with about three or four rounds to go.
Yeah,
so it's just been accumulating points. But.
So looking at the just another thing to note, just poor old Oriel, after suffering away for the 3 days, and you know he was
munching through uni flu.
Oh man, he was horsing him back, but I don't know if they were doing much. But he would have got a point or two. Not that you know Oriel didn't have a great year anyway, but it, you know, it would have been nice for the guy to get some reward for his work. But transmission went to him on stage 15, so that put him out. So that was a bit of a downer of a weekend for him. McRae, again, this is like the Focus at the time had a reputation for being a tough car, and it might have been, as in, you know, when in the context of it could take impacts well, or it could take, you know, hitting something hard pretty well and get away. But McRae lost time again with gearbox issues. This is the second rally in a row where the car has left him down in, you know, a silly, you know, small way, if you want to call it that. He had issues selecting gears. He had to switch back to manual gear change, I think, for the last couple of stages. So he actually ended up losing out on a couple of manufacturer points over that. He was set to take Kenneth Hergson, but he ended up behind him. So, you know, it's just...
He actually, on the last stage, he dropped a whole load of time. Like, he could have got, I'm just looking here now, 16. Yeah, wasn't beyond the bounds of possibility. Yeah, 16 and 17, he dropped a whole lot of time. Remember, wasn't there a clip? I was just thinking there as well. It was the camera was looking back at McRae, and he was just hammering the gear lever, trying to get a gear.
That was happening earlier in the day as well, on the first stage out that morning, because it had to be said, on the previous day, he put seven stage wins together in a row. So you would have expected him to start, you know, the final day on typical McRae attitude, full attack. And I think he was eighth or ninth fastest. And the onboard footage shows that pulling a gear, first time didn't get it, second time got it. And it happened a couple of times. So it must have been something underlying that was giving trouble all day with that.
Yeah, I mean, like,
there was another big battle going on as well there during the day. That I think, while you'd be so focused on Mäkinen chasing down Rovan Pera, Salberg, Gardemeister, and Delacour went into the final stage, drawing 9 seconds, covering the three of them.
Okay, yeah, that was Salberg eventually got back up to some bit of speed, and he actually ended up taking a point out of the rally, which was, you know, which I suppose you could say kind of a rebuilding exercise for him after the off in Monty, so it was good to see him get a result. We have to give a shout out to Thomas Radstrom as well for, you know, a great performance. You know, he probably was a little bit holding back a small bit. He obviously didn't want it to be overtaking Mäkinen. And, you know, going by his performance on the first day and into the rest of the rally, you know, he could well have kept Mäkinen honest, you know, which is, again, impressive in a car that definitely, as we've said numerous times, was not the easiest thing to drive. So,
that result arguably got him a contract with Citroën for a year. He did a rally for Citroën then later that year, and then he did most of the 2002 season.
Yeah, that's good. Fair play to him on that. Carlos Sainz then, again, good old Carlos into third. Was less than 10 seconds off Radstrom in the end. So, like, this is the thing. Again, Sainz was rallying an awful long time at this stage, but was still up at the sharp end on any event you care to mention. So, you know, just pure class. Gardemeister in fourth. Again, another good showing from Gardemeister. Like, you know, there's 2 points scoring finishes in the first two rounds.
Second fastest on the last stage.
Yeah, inside in a privateer car. So, again, fair play to him. Delacour was fifth. So, like, again, this just shows this season, you know, Delacour had a decent run in the Monte as well. And if you look at the points leaderboard in the first half of the season compared to the second half, it was just totally opposite. Like, it was crazy. But, again, good showings from him. So, and
He always went relatively well in Sweden, Delacour.
Yeah, which is, and New Zealand as well, which was, like, for a man born and bred in the south of France and an absolute demon on tarmac, you know, you wouldn't imagine he'd be two at home in two of the quickest, loose surface rallies, but no, fair play to the guy.
He never got fantastic results in Sweden, apart from that time, but he was always up there on the times, and then at some bit of bother. It was, any rally that was fast seemed to suit Delacour.
Delacour's a hero. Delacour still thinks that if you put him, he's convinced himself that if he got into a modern world car, that he'd be up at the sharp end of the field. And I, you know, it's hard to doubt the guy because he's just a phenomenal talent, an absolute lunatic. And as we mentioned in the last episode,
actually, while we're on about Delacour tangents, have you ever seen the video of him? He's doing some rally in Romania in a Group N Subaru, and he pulls up to this woman for an interview, and he does a whole speed about a carrot that he found on his windscreen that morning.
Yeah, I've seen that. Absolutely Jesus, insane.
It's unbelievable. We'll throw it into the description whenever you post this up, or we'll put it as a follow on tweet or something. It's just the most sensational bit of lunacy you've ever seen.
He'd won in Everton, didn't he? Or he was.
He won the rally. Yeah.
And all he wanted to talk about was the carrot.
And all he wanted, and look into my eyes, and Jesus, super stuff.
My favourite Delacour moment is the bit where he had, I think it was like Group N 206, some local fella had us out on a rally, and Delacour went out and did a run over the super special stage. Like, man didn't need to, he's above it. There he is in what's essentially just a little 1.6, 206 doing the jump through the super special. You know, he's purely about the sport and that's it.
Yeah. So just the guy that just loves driving and as you said, loves the sport. But again, in the unlikely event that Francois ever hears this podcast, shout out to you, man. We're big fans. But anyway.
And he's in good tight shape for a man of his age too. Not a pick on him.
He's like a lat. Jesus, man. They're in the fucking, he's unbelievable. Like, yeah.
Fantastic with the saucepan lid as well. Have you seen that video where he's showing his driving technique with the saucepan lid?
No,
yeah.
you need to start linking these onto us, man.
Share
these around. But just a quick, a brief look at the driver standings after round two. There was not much point looking after round one because obviously they were the same as the final leaderboard results. But Mäkinen, despite his off, joined first with Robin Pera, and Sainz was actually joint leader in the championship as well, 10 points based on his finishes in the Monty and Sweden. So Thomas Radstrom in fourth, and Delacour in joint fourth, and Garda Meisterden in sixth. So again, as we said, just a crazy kind of a leaderboard for the start of the year, but just showed the level of talent through the field. You know, all those guys were, you know, there on merit. They were the.
I'm just looking there. After Gardemeister is sixth in the championship, the next cars in the championship after him, Armin Schwartz is seventh. He didn't finish Sweden. Freddy Lights is eighth. He didn't score points. And Salberg is in giant eighth place after scoring his 1 point there. So you're even going down to giant eighth place in the championship, and you still haven't got three of the main contenders that are going to be fighting it out at the end of the season. It's nuts.
Exactly, yeah. No, it's just the strength.
And don't give the story away. Don't give the story away.
I know. Surely be to God, people at this stage know, but sure, look, we're taking a kind of a fun look back in it, yeah.
And Mitsubishi leading the manufacturers as well.
Yeah, and Skoda and Tord.
23 points.
In a car, many people had written off, though, because only for the upgrades over the year. Like, a lot of people had deemed it yesterday's car, and like you said, they are leading after, you know, the second round in the championship. They're the top manufacturers. People have signed that car nearly to the history books.
Yeah. So I suppose, just in summary, another exciting event, another totally unpredictable event. Again, you wouldn't have thought that going into the start of the rally that the Robin Pera would have been coming out number one. It's debatable if Granholm would stay going, whether he would have been left be number one. But look, that's not taking anything away from the guy. As you said, that was a brilliant win. It was done in a brilliant fashion. It's just a pity he didn't get more throughout his career. But no, stunning drive. And again, you know, it was the kind of championship where every round counted, every finish and every round counted towards the end of the year. Especially in the likes of Tommy's case there, where, you know, they moved away from that car into the world car, and you know that caused its own set of issues as we'll find out. But no, just again, just goes to show.
I'm just looking there as well. I wonder, was that the last rally that a woman was on the podium? Tina Turner was navigating for Thomas Radstrom.
Been
on the podium with who?
Manfred Stoll.
He got a podium.
Yeah,
I think so.
He's the mid 2000s.
The Baron, yeah. The Baron period of the WRC. I think Cyprus is in my head for some reason, but that's oh, something we must check that out. Yeah, but yeah, no, fair play, Tina Turner there sitting in, not the singer Tina Turner, but no. But,
no, I think two of the drives of the rally, with the exception of Harry Robin Pera and Thomas Radstrom, for me, the drives of the rally were from Tony Gardemeister and Daniel Carlson. I think it's more the fact that they were independent teams, I think, and the fact they were still able to race in amongst them. Like, to finish fourth, you know, like two top five finishes, one after the other, in a privateer car for Gardemeister, that's fantastic results. But Daniel Carlson, you know, went on to do the JWRC and subsequently got taken on into work scenes. He's set in top four times in what even you'd admit is an outdated car, the Corolla, but still a fantastic tool for a privateer to use, and steadily inside the top 10. They would have been two of the drives of the rally.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I just find it hard to look past Robin Pera in this event. He was just stunning from start to finish. You know, not taking anything away from the other guys. But you know, all credit to the guy. This was his event, and he took the bull by the horns in this one. Once he saw he had the chance,
it wasn't only the fact he won it; it was the way he won it. As we mentioned earlier, it was a proper way to win a rally: get out in front and then just control it.
Yeah, no, totally agree. So, yeah, so that pretty much wraps up our Rally Sweden coverage. Again, 19 years later. Hopefully you haven't been waiting out and hearing the results. But, yeah, But
refreshing the BBC Sport website. Remember, they used to have a dedicated rally section on their website. Oh, it's probably still there, is it?
I don't
know. Page 360 on CFAX.
Yeah. Yeah, you could probably enter that BBC Sport website in the Wayback Machine. I'm sure you'd find something, but I don't know. I imagine there'd be a sea of broken links awaiting you.
I've actually just typed it into the laptop here in front of me. It's come up. .stm, whatever that is. That's some old format. I must send that on later. The background is like old beige, and it's just blocks of... Yeah, there probably is a lot of broken links here.
Yeah, Netscape.
Unreal.
Yeah. Love it. But anyway, so that, as I said, that wraps us up. So for myself, thanks again for listening. If you've made it this far, hopefully you're enjoying the look back into one of the greatest seasons of the WRC there ever has been or ever will be, I imagine. So look, we appreciate, as I said at the start, we appreciate all your comments. So people have
feck all else to do anyway.
Sure, that's it, sure. What else are you doing? I listen to us rabble on shite about
To be fair, it's a great way of doing your 2 kilometers around the block repetitively and staying within that 2 kilometer perimeter.
It is, yeah. Hashtag stay at home. But so as I said, look, give us a like and subscribe. Keep an eye on us on the various social media platforms. Follow us on those as well for more car and rally related rubbish is the only way to describe it. But sure, it's entertaining rubbish. But thanks for
it. We're entertaining ourselves. We're happy.
And what's next then? Portugal.
Yeah, Portugal is the next round. So we'll next week's episode is.
That's an absolute banger.
Yeah. Wait for you're in for a treat, Rally Portugal, if you like. You know,
the weather's good, I believe, coming up though, isn't it?
Debatable. Good. The bins and good. What your definition of good is, but yeah. So
I have a high-end short pack for it, so I'm happy.
Stay tuned for the next round in Portugal. But until then, from myself, Morris, and from Tommy and Art, good luck.
Bye.
And we'll talk to you soon.
See you, lads.